Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, Canada's first online financial news and research service, providing insider news and knowledge to investors. His website, CanadianInsider.com, home of the Canadian Insider Club. Welcome back to the show, Ted.
Jim, thanks for having me back, and all the best for 2024 to you and all your listeners.
You have a base case about why resource-based stocks might give you a bit of a hedge if we have an economic downturn or if there's more geopolitical shenanigans, which, you know, with Iran sending missiles into Pakistan and so on, it just gets messier and messier in the Middle East.
Complicated is another way to describe it, but yes, it's definitely messy. And I think that the resource stocks can help hedge the geopolitical risk if we were to get a U.S. or global economic downturn. That's another story. And in that situation, resource stocks would not be all that well. But when we've got this volatility that's surrounding the geopolitical risks that are really confronting investors, many investors have never faced this type of risk. Now, some have. Some of your listeners who are, may remember the kind of 70s or, you know, and some of the lead up to that around Vietnam. It was a little bit before my time, but it's been a long time since we've had this kind of geopolitics. And I think there's a massive denial in the market about the importance of geopolitics and what's at stake here. And what I mean by that is really the assumptions underpinning the U.S. dollar as reserve currency and the impact that the future path of the U.S. dollar will have on resource markets. So, to cut a long story short, if the U.S. dollar weakens, that will, on balance, help inflate the prices of commodities, minerals, oil and gas. I mean, there's other factors that go in that are involved, of course, the supply and demand in all these markets. But just in general, weaker dollar will be supportive of commodity markets and stronger dollar will be a headwind. So the developments in the Middle East and the Red Sea in particular are very important for the future path of the U.S. dollar in terms of its status as a world currency, a world's reserve currency. Now, just to be clear, I'm not at all suggesting that the U.S. dollar is going to lose its reserve status, that it's going to, collapse or anything like that. No, that's not the point. The point is that, as these situations become riskier for more countries in the world, it could lead to a diversification of central bank reserves and in individuals in terms of their allocations, which would put a downward force on the U.S. dollar over time. So it would be, it's basically just the process of diversification by central banks and others that would lead to a downward pressure on the dollar, which is compounded by the growing U.S. dollar, U.S. Government deficits, which will be compounded by ongoing geopolitical risk as they are required to buy more missiles, fix more ships, send more sailors back out to the Red Sea from North America back and forth. It all starts to add up. We haven't heard a lot about the costs yet because it's early days, but if this drags on, you're going to hear more and more about so-called supplemental requests from the president to the Congress for money. And we've actually are in a situation right now where the president is asking for, I don't know, is it $50 billion, $100 billion, it's still being negotiated, but more money for Ukraine, Israel, and the border wall, which means extra money beyond all everything that's already been planned. They're negotiating that, and we'll see if that gets added to the U.S. deficit when that agreement is if that an agreement is struck. So the resource exposures that one can get from the Canadian market offers a hedge to this situation where you've got growing geopolitical risks, the growing military requirements of the NATO bloc and the U.S. To counter those risks. You know, all requires more money to fund the U.S. deficit, which will put downward pressure on the dollar, per se, and also, you need more materials. You know, if you're going to build more boats and build more tanks and build more and get more produce more missiles, it all requires materials. So, resource stocks can be a hedge on that front. But of course, there are risks to that thinking, and we've seen some of them earlier this year. We've seen the U.S. dollar rally. Now, why is that? Well, there are a lot of, you know, foreign exchange traders who are kind of hardwired into looking, oh, you know, interest rates up, dollar up. And this is kind of a short-term view of the market, which is, you know, everyone has different time horizons. So a forex trader or a short-term speculator is going to go with what they think works, and they will keep doing it until it doesn't work. And generally, you know, this betting on the U.S. dollar when even bond yields go up, you know, is something in the short term that has worked. But I'm skeptical that that's going to continue to work, because as this U.S. deficit gets bigger and bigger, eventually, and this is eventually is the important word here, it will eventually become clear that this is not really a virtuous circle of sort of more debt and more growth and higher interest rates. But it's actually kind of a merry-go-round, and at some point the music will stop, and if you're caught really long U.S. dollars, when that music stops, it's going to not be a kind of a, you know, the party's going to end, let's just say that. But, you know, when that merry-go-round stops, when it becomes clear to even short-term traders that, you know, higher bond yields mean, you know, are happening because the U.S. government needs to borrow more, and that likely means a lower dollar to attract the foreign capital needed to fund that debt. You know, we're not there yet, per se. I think we're getting pretty close because looking at some of these bond auctions. But once you've got the short-term traders aligned with kind of the more long-term thinking, I think, of what's going on in terms of people diversifying and central banks diversifying their reserves into other currencies and also gold, and that's kind of what we're most interested in, then I think you will have quite the risk of very strong momentum in terms of resources and commodities. We're not there, obviously, in the first few weeks of the year, and we may not get there, but it is nevertheless a hedge towards that scenario where you've got increasing costs in the economy that are being driven by geopolitics, essentially, that require the U.S. to basically keep up with the risks that are out there by spending more and maintaining, you know, a strong military. And, you know, it all takes money. So, and that will not eventually be U.S. dollar positive.
Now, we talk about, okay, Middle East oil has to go around the Horn now instead of through the Red Sea. But the U.S. now produces enough energy that it actually exports oil. So does that keep the price of oil down?
Well, that's a very interesting dynamic that goes on, because in a sense, the higher the oil price goes, the better it is for the U.S. in the sense that, you know, they export their net export. Or I believe they're still a net exporter of oil, and they will get some foreign exchange for that oil. But it's so complicated, you know, and I'm not going to try and profess to be able to provide the formula in terms of at what point, you know, higher oil prices are good for the U.S. dollar, or if they even are on balance, because there's so many other factors, like, as I mentioned, the deficit. It's going to be complicated, and it's going to be volatile. So those are kind of the, guaranteed for 2024 volatility and complexity. But boiling it down to, you know, to something we can get our heads around, look, you know, even if the U.S. is producing more oil, and it's been hitting, I believe, new records, that's going to help, and that's probably a big reason why we've got moderate prices in terms of oil and gas. But we will have to see how long increased U.S. production can keep up with global demand, and a lot will depend on your kind of opening, you know, question about the global growth. If we do head into a recession, then of course this is not going to be good for the oil price, and it will be the economic slowdown that will keep the oil price down. If the economy continues to grow globally, which is our base case, you know, I expect to see slow upward pressure on the oil price, and you know, you would have to have really moderate oil demand in order for the U.S. to be able to kind of meet that, because I mean the growth, it's growing, but it's not growing by, you know, 500,000 barrels a year. It's you know, we're talking marginal, you know, marginal barrels added every year. And so whether it's enough to keep you know, to keep supply, keep the world well supplied with their kind of like crude that they provide, you know, we will have to see. But you know, I think so long as the world keeps growing here, the oil price should do okay. We're coming out of the seasonally weak period, but it's, you know, again, it is very difficult to sort of get your head around the supply and demand dynamics of the oil price. But again, so long as we're not in a slow growth or recessionary environment, you know, things, you know, the oil price should at least be able to kind of stay in the current range, which is fine for most Canadian producers.
We'll have more with Ted Dixon right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Ted Dixon. Ted, you said resource stocks could be a hedge against geopolitical shenanigans. Any particular resources?
Well, we kicked the year off that we thought 2024 would be a good year for the porphyry elephant hunt. You know, looking for those juniors who are looking for those gold and copper deposits. That, you know, they have both those minerals, and because why? Well, because gold would be a way to diversify out of the U.S. dollar for those countries and investors who want to do that, and copper will be needed for a whole range of industrial needs, including, you know, EV transit, electric transition. So even in BC, we're kind of planning to expand the grid here, build up the grid. They just announced, I think, a $30 billion plus investment program into the grid. Look, if these countries want to do any kind of EV transition, they're going to have to build more capacity in their grid. That's going to be pro copper. Now, of course, the flip side is, well, China housing gloom, And I don't expect the China housing market. I'm not a housing expert, but I'd be surprised if the housing market in China rebounds rapidly anytime soon. I don't think that's the base case. But, you know, we've already priced a lot of that into the copper market. I don't think we've priced a lot of the demand that's going to be coming down the road. And maybe rightly so, because, you know, this whole transition, it hasn't been really that well managed, you know, by the Western governments. I mean, you just look at what's happening in places like Germany, and who were caught short in terms of being able to supply their own domestic energy needs. So there's been a bit of a headwind for copper, just, I would think, on the poor management of this whole transition effort. But look, the world is continuing to grow, and, you know, copper will be in continual demand, and the transition to a more electrified economy is still and eventually that will catch up with the copper supply, in our view. So look, gold and copper, you know, that it should be a good year for gold and copper. And but the trick is, I think, not to get distracted by these kind of we view as short-term rallies in the U.S. dollar, subject to those risks that we talked about earlier, that, you know, if traders continue to view higher U.S. rates as being pro-U.S. dollar, then that will be a headwind whenever that narrative gains traction. But, I think that, based off of what's needed in terms of both financial diversification and industrial needs, copper gold deposits, those should be on the radar of more and more investors this year. So we'll see if that plays out.
Now, is lithium ever going to come back?
Interesting question. We just saw a deal done in the junior market this week, where a uranium miner developer, they no longer have a, as far as I know, producing asset, but they're advancing a large project, and it's a very well known name. You can look on my Twitter feed. I tweeted out the announcement, but they've made a strategic investment to a Saskatchewan direct lithium extraction company, and so that was really quite a surprise to see a uranium player head into the lithium space. It was probably, you know, it was a contrarian move, probably an astute move, you know, because they're getting 75% option in this DLE play that's got a preliminary economic assessment of, I think, you know, about $1 billion. I mean, those are kind of wish list reports, those PEAs, but nevertheless. This company has this option now to participate into this project that has the potential. And I say it's not a certainty by any stretch, but has the potential to provide lithium out of Saskatchewan in a very innovative way. So while investors have been dismayed by, I think, some of the issues we talked about earlier about this sort of frustrating energy transition in the West, and then you've got this lithium price collapse in China, which has very little to do with North America. I mean, these battery plants that are on the drawing boards and under construction, they are going to need to source their lithium from places like Saskatchewan or Quebec, or, you know, other mines in North America, if they want to get the full tax treatment. So this development in China about the falling lithium price, yes, it's obviously going to impact sentiment in the short term, but not for those who believe in the business case going forward over the next sort of 3 to 10 years. What's happening in the lithium price in China right now is pretty much irrelevant. So, and I think we've seen that with a big move in, not a big move, but this announcement into the Saskatchewan junior. And we've also, I should say, seen two nice investments into junior nickel two nickel juniors in Canada already in 2024, one based in Ontario and one based in British Columbia, both Asian. They've attracted money from Asian investors, players in the critical mineral space out of Asia. So while investors have maybe become frustrated, stock market investors over the past year, some of the big players, you know, are still looking down the road and cutting some big checks into the Canadian junior market, where while investors are kind of getting maybe a little frustrated. So that's also very encouraging for 2024, and it's actually caught me by surprise to see some of these deals already. So it is encouraging, especially when you get these kind of two or three week periods where the U.S. dollar is rallying, and you're going, oh no, you know, you go back to that. There's still some people out there who believe in lithium gin.
Ted, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on?
I just surprised at what we're seeing on our screens. We just produced our first top 40 report for 2024, and basically, the theme is diversity. You know, the title of the report is A Variety of Names to Start 2024. In our list, we got nine sectors have made it into the list. And interestingly, and this was a big surprise, we've seen three or four alternative medicine stocks come in. And you remember the pot stocks, Jim, a long time ago, how they were all the rage in Canada? Well, you know, there have been a few that look like they've emerged as potential survivors, and some of the names that were not prevalent 3 or 4 years ago are making our screens now. So that's interesting, if there's one surprise so far of 2024, it would be this kind of reappearance of some of these alternative medicine stocks. So that will be one to watch. It's very surprising to me, but, there's a lot of other opportunities out there, for those who are not into that that type of speculation, because I think it's still speculation. But they are these winners do have revenue, and some are generating cash. So the industry is reaching, I think, a little a period of kind of, hopefully, I won't call it maturity. I don't think we're that at that stage yet, but certainly seeing some signs of who the winners might be. So that's interesting. That wasn't on my bingo card in December, but here we are in January, and alternative medicine. Who would have thought? Here we go.
Ted, thank you so much for being on the show.
Jim, thanks for having me back.
My guest has been Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, his website, CanadianInsider.com. If you have any questions for Ted or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. We'll ask that question for you. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.